This is Jess Goldson, and you are listening to CJRU 1280 AM here in Toronto. This story, The Cost of Egg Donation, the second of four episodes in the series titled Waves of Knowing, is part of the Local Journalism Initiative, a project by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. The previous story covered in vitro fertilization, or IVF, and the impact of COVID-19. Today, we will explore egg donation, how it is facilitated, and the implications for both parents and donors. Sarah Cohen, LLP of D2 Law Fertility Law, explains the egg donor agreement in Canada between the donor and the parent or parents.
So, the first thing you need to know is the federal law, which is that it's illegal to pay an egg donor in Canada or to pay someone on her behalf. And the way to deal with that is to do altruistic donation, which is where the egg donor donates her eggs without compensation. She is allowed to be reimbursed for her expenses that she incurs as a result of the egg donation, but she's not allowed to make money off of it. She also must be at least 18 years old or older. The other way of getting around it is by using an egg from an egg bank. And if that's the situation, usually we're importing donor eggs from the United States in particular, where they are allowed to compensate egg donors. But because we're not buying the egg from a donor or a person acting on behalf of a donor, but from an egg bank itself, it actually gets around that law. So if you are using a donor here in Canada, you're probably going to enter into an egg donor agreement with her to make it clear who is a parent and who's not a parent. In Ontario, for example, the law is actually quite good. It's very clear that a donor is not a parent and a parent is a parent, but you want to be clear who is the donor and who is a parent, because Ontario law is also so progressive that it allows all of the people to be parents together. So we want to be clear who is a donor and who is a parent. The agreement will also deal with exchange of information. So, for example, do you want the donor to have an obligation to update the parents if she finds out new medical information that could affect the health of the child? What happens if the child wants to reach out to the donor? Is that permissible? And how are we going to do that? What are we allowed to do with excess eggs or embryos that aren't used for the reproductive purposes of the intended parents? And such other matters are dealt with an egg donor agreement.
Cohen describes the impact Canadian legislation has on Canadians' access to donor gametes, sperm, and eggs.
So one of the biggest problems with our legislation, in my opinion, is the piece of legislation is called the Assisted Human Reproduction Act, and it criminalizes compensating egg donors, sperm donors, and surrogates in Canada. And the problem with that is we end up relying incredibly heavily on donor sperm from America in particular, and donor eggs now from the United States in particular, because in the United States, you are allowed to compensate the sperm donor and egg donor. So they have lots of donors, whereas we have very, very few donors in Canada as a result of this legislation. And because we import the donor sperm, donor eggs, it's legal in the United States to compensate sperm donors and egg donors. And Canadians aren't directly paying usually the donor in the United States, but they are paying the sperm bank or egg bank. And that's a way around our legislation, because you're not paying a donor or a person acting on behalf of a donor, you're paying a bank which owns the gametes outright.
Cohen describes the impact of importing our genetics.
We have a lot of kind of fallout problems that I see associated with this. And some of them are that, for example, our populations are not identical. So there are people in Canada who need to use donor gametes, so donor sperm or donor eggs, that want these donor sperm or donor eggs to be representative of their heritage, and they cannot find people in Canada who are representative of their heritage. They try to import from the United States, and those populations don't look identical. Perhaps even a bigger problem, in my opinion, is that the United States is generally much more interested in anonymous donation than we are. And because we are importing from the United States, we really can't decide what they get to do or don't get to do. So they have all this anonymous anonymously donated sperm and eggs that come into Canada, and we don't have that information to provide it to the children who are conceived through the use of these donor eggs, donor sperm. And if we had donors here in Canada, we could require the use of something called a donor registry, which would have to be dealt with on a provincial basis. But it really doesn't make a lot of sense right now when so much of our donor gametes are imported. Another problem is that in the United States, there's not a law on how many times you're allowed to use the same donor sperm, for example. So we're using sometimes the same donor sperm that has been used many, many, many times, again and again and again, to conceive children. And that's particularly problematic in certain communities that tend to rely heavily on donor sperm. So for example, queer communities that rely heavily on the use of donor sperm, some of these children might be related to each other and not know it.
Professor Alana Catapan is an assistant professor and the Canada Research Chair in the Politics of Reproduction in the Department of Political Science at the University of Waterloo in Ontario. Catapan explains that the push towards eliminating clauses on commercialization of gametes creates new problems.
Without regulation of that payment or regulation of those relationships between surrogates or egg donors and agencies that engage with them and the families, I think that we're actually creating a bigger problem by having unregulated payment.
Catapan describes the process of stimulating the ovaries to produce a greater number of eggs than the 1 to 2 egg yield during a regular menstrual cycle. These eggs are then extracted through the vagina.
Egg donation is a procedure where it's multi-stage, it's invasive, and it involves weeks of hormonal injections followed by an extraction of those eggs, which I think I said before. That happens for in vitro fertilization as well, but in egg donation, the eggs go to somebody else. And hormonal injections and the extraction of the eggs, like just the injections themselves over and over, and the transvaginal extraction, are not without their own risks. They have some risks. But egg donation is pretty risky for another reason. The stimulation of the ovaries through those hormonal injections, I even hesitate to call them hormonal injections, but they're involve hormones, they're medical injections. They stimulate the ovaries to produce extra eggs, more than you would normally produce in a month. Now, like normally you produce 1, maybe 2 eggs. A healthy stimulation of the ovaries produces under 20 eggs, maybe 6, maybe 10, max 20 is what they're looking for, what we know in clinical guidelines.
Catapan argues that more urgent than lobbying to compensate donors is ensuring that donors are treated safely.
I certainly hear stories from advocates in this field of women she had interviewed was producing 90 eggs in a cycle, and that is extremely bad for the donor. And what happens in those cases, you know, if you're looking past 20, is that women might experience what's called ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome. There's mild, medium, extreme forms of this, but when it's severe, it can cause infertility, kidney failure, respiratory distress, blood clots, in stroke, and death in some cases, although the statistics on this are unclear. There was a case of a woman who had provided her eggs in Toronto and then gotten on a plane to go back to Florida, where she was from. She'd been crossing borders to do this, who had a stroke that is a pretty well-documented case, and there were court cases that ensued. So while there have been some studies of the effects of ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome for women undergoing in vitro fertilization, because they also have their ovaries stimulated in a similar fashion, egg donors undergo this process for somebody else. And what we hear from egg donors and the very limited research that does exist in this field is that egg donors may experience considerably higher rates of ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome. So the number that's often thrown around is that it's 1 or 2% of women total that might experience ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome after undergoing these procedures. Donors suggest that that is not the case, that it is substantially higher. We're hoping to do more research on this, but a representative of an organization called We Are Egg Donors laughs when people bring that number up. She thinks that it's outrageous that anyone would cite that number, because it is certainly not the case. So this isn't to say that there aren't great doctors out there, or some women are very well taken care of, but donors are there to produce eggs for somebody else, and they're often treated that way. the goal is to extract as many high quality eggs from donors as possible. And Allison Motluck, who's a well-known journalist in this field, who's won national magazine awards for her work on egg donation, publishes a newsletter called Hey ReproTech. And she describes an instance where she was with an egg donor and they went into the clinic and they entered through the front door and they left through the back door. And that is the experience that donors are often articulating. Not all donors, people have different kinds of experiences in this field, but certainly this is the case in many situations. So even though more and more people are using egg donation in Canada and around the world, and women have been egg donors for a long time now, it is really telling that there is no research on whether this process is safe for donors in the long term. Because the people who have access to donors, who can track this progress, are people in the fertility clinics themselves. Those are the people with the charts who could be doing follow-up care and follow-up studies. But we also hear about less than robust follow-up care for these women. A few years ago, the New York Times published an article called "Do Egg Donors Face Long-Term Risks?" Speculating about like when research in this field will get done, articulating that we still don't know if egg donation is safe in the long term. And so when I think about outcomes for donors, how do we center the experiences of people who are providing their genetic material, or in the case of women who act as surrogates, providing their bodies to help other people build families? Intended parents, people trying to build families, are important and are usually committed to engaging in this process, building their families in really ethical ways. They want to do that. They want to make sure that they have a family and are hopeful that they can do so in a way that treats everybody in the process really well. I believe in the capacity of Canadians and of public policy to make changes to this system so that we can do that. We can achieve building families in robust, ethical, supportive ways that treats everybody well.
This is Jess Goldson, and you've been listening to CJRU 1280 AM here in Toronto. This story, The Cost of Egg Donation, the second of four episodes in this series titled Waves of Knowing, is part of the Local Journalism Initiative, a project by the Community Radio Fund of Canada.